Picture a room in Paris.
Okay.
The year is 1832, and it is the dead of night. Like the kind of absolute heavy darkness you really only get in those early hours of the morning right before the city wakes up.
Right, where the silence is almost oppressive.
Exactly. And the room is cold, it's damp, and it's lit by just this single candle that is burning dangerously low. The wax is pooling and hardening on this scarred wooden table.
Setting the scene here.
Yeah, and sitting there, hunched over this flickering light, is a 20-year-old boy, and he is frantically writing.
I mean, scratching mathematical equations across this parchment as fast as his hand can possibly move.
Yes, he isn't pausing to think. He isn't checking his work. He is just pouring everything left in his mind onto the page because, well, he's running out of time.
He knows with absolute chilling certainty that he has a duel at dawn, and he knows he's going to die.
It's just such a visceral image. And here's the detail that really anchored me when we were preparing for today's deep dive into our source material. Down the margin of this page that holds the most important mathematics this young man will ever produce, he scrawls the same five words over and over again in this jagged
I
handwriting.
have no time.
I have no time. I have no time.
It is a staggering historical vignette. I mean, when you look at the actual documents from that night, the sheer desperation of it just jumps right off the page.
Yeah.
We are talking about a mind operating at the absolute frontier of human comprehension, fully aware that its existence is about to be violently terminated.
And that young man was Évariste Girouard.
Right, and the tragic reality is that his prediction was entirely correct. He went to that duel in a field, he took a bullet to the abdomen, and he died in a hospital a couple of days later at 20.
20 years old. It's heartbreaking. But the pages didn't die with him, right?
No, but they almost did. The pages he emptied himself into during those final desperate hours, they went completely unread for over a decade, just sitting in a pile gathering dust.
Wow.
But eventually, a prominent mathematician named Joseph Louville found them. He spent months untangling the frantic handwriting, and he realized what he was looking at.
Which was foundational, right?
Completely foundational.
Yeah.
Those chaotic pages went on to found an entirely new branch of algebra, what we now call Galois theory. I mean, it's a branch of mathematics so fundamental that we still teach it to university students today.
So the work itself triumphed over time.
It won, but the boy was erased. And as the central thesis of our material today notes so hauntingly, the world, as it tends to, kept the cheaper half.
The will keeps the cheaper half. Man, that phrase has been ringing in my head all week.
It's heavy.
It really is. And that story, that haunting image of Galois in his final hours, it sets the stage perfectly for the mission of our deep dive today.
Yes, it does.
We are exploring an incredibly challenging, I'd say paradigm-shifting framework called the uncounted ledger, why contribution outlives fame. And our goal today isn't just to give you a tour of forgotten history.
The ambition of this material is much larger than that.
Much larger. We are here to fundamentally rewire how you view success, how you view your legacy, and most importantly, how you value the quiet, uncelebrated moments of your own life.
Because over the next hour or so, we are going to tackle the core problem presented in this framework, the mechanics of what gets kept and what gets thrown away.
Right.
We're going to completely deconstruct the illusion of the historical record as you currently understand it. We'll examine the actual hidden architecture of how human progress happens in the shadows, far away from the spotlight of the history books.
And we are going to figure out how you can apply this profound shift in perspective to your own daily existence. So I want to speak directly to you listening right now.
Yeah, lean in for this part.
Whether you are managing a team of 50 people, whether you're trying to build a family, or if you're just an individual trying to leave your little corner of the world slightly better than you found it, this deep dive is going to challenge the way you evaluate your own worth.
It really will.
It is going to validate all of the quiet, invisible work that you do every single day that nobody will ever write a book about. Okay, let's unpack this. We need to start by tearing down an illusion we have all been subjected to since our first grade social studies class.
The illusion of the history book.
Exactly.
The material introduces a demographic reality right at the beginning that is deliberately designed to completely unsettle your sense of scale.
I know it unsettled mine.
Oh, absolutely. Think about every human being who has ever walked the earth over the last, say, 50,000 years. Billions upon billions of complex, dreaming, working human lives.
Right.
The fraction of those people who surface anywhere in the historical record, and we are talking the lowest possible bar here.
Yeah.
Just a name on a tax ledger, a date on a parish registry, a single line in a local chronicle.
Just proof they existed.
Exactly. That fraction is functionally zero. Some demographic historians put it at roughly one in hundreds of thousands for the vast majority of human epochs.
That is, I mean, that's just a terrifying number to wrap your head around.
You don't even need to mathematically verify the exact decimal. What you have to confront is the direction of the error. The core thesis here is that the historical record isn't just a summary. It is an almost entirely empty room.
It is an empty room, and yet we treat it like it's the whole house.
Yes.
You know, when I was trying to wrap my head around this massive scale of erasure, I thought about how we consume sports.
Oh, like this.
Imagine you were someone who has never heard of the game of basketball.
Okay.
And I tell you, I'm going to teach you everything there is to know about the sport, its rules, its flow, its culture. But the only piece of media I show you is a highlight reel of slam dunks.
Right, just the biggest plays.
Just 3 straight hours of Michael Jordan, LeBron James, and Vince Carter jumping from the free throw line and shattering backboards.
That's a great visual.
If that highlight reel is your only source of data, your only historical record of basketball, what kind of game do you think you're watching?
You would conclude that the sport is played entirely in the air.
Exactly.
You'd assume the core mechanic of the game is just defying gravity.
You would think the players never even dribble.
Right.
You would think they never pass the ball, that they don't sweat, that they don't run exhausting defensive drills, that they don't sit on the bench nursing an injured ankle. You would look at the footage and conclude that these superhuman beings just exist in a state of constant explosive climax.
That analogy actually captured the deception of the medium perfectly. A highlight reel, by its very nature, aggressively removes all the connective tissue.
It deletes the mundane.
It deletes the foundational mundane work that makes the climax mathematically possible in the first place. And the core argument here is that humanity has spent centuries doing the exact same thing with our own story.
We are mistaking the highlight reel for the actual film of human history.
Precisely. We read our past as this grand, unbroken chain of spectacular milestones. We visualize one great figure, usually a king, a general, or a brilliant inventor, proudly handing the torch of civilization directly to the next great figure.
And when you look back in hindsight, that line looks incredibly clean. It feels inevitable.
But the material is telling us that the line only looks clean because we literally swept 99.9% of the human experience into the incinerator.
Wow.
We threw away everything that wasn't a milestone.
It's so true. And if you look closely enough at how history is constructed, you can actually see what the author calls the splice marks.
The splice marks, yes, where the film was artificially cut together.
Consider the mechanics of it. Chroniclers and historians of any given era only recorded contemporaries they found immediately compelling or dangerous.
Usually that meant people with massive resources, people causing violent disruption, or people starting wars.
Right. And then hindsight steps in and plays a very cruel narrative trick on us.
It takes those few surviving, often violent names and reads them backward into a logical progression. It creates a retroactive storyline that makes it seem as though all of human events were organically steering toward those few famous names we happen to keep.
It's the ultimate confirmation bias. We have the result, the current world, so we tell a story that makes the result seem destined by a few geniuses.
Destined, yeah.
But what about the millions of people living between those splice marks? The rest of humanity perished without note. But the text makes a crucial distinction here that I think we really need to linger on.
Let's do it.
They didn't perish without note because they did nothing. They perished without note because nothing they did on a daily basis announced itself as a Tuesday worth recording.
A Tuesday worth recording. That phrase really anchors the philosophy.
Mm.
Because what is the actual texture of daily existence?
Mostly chores, honestly.
Right. Most of life is maintenance. It is the friction of keeping things running. It is solving minor logistical problems, feeding people, sweeping the floor, tending to the sick, figuring out a tiny, imperceptible improvement to an agricultural tool.
None of that screams out to a scribe to be preserved for eternity. I mean, if someone were tasked with documenting my week for the historical record, it would be a disaster.
Oh, same here.
Tuesday, sent 12 emails, attended a meeting that really could have been an email, paid the electricity bill, made a really good grilled cheese sandwich.
A historic grilled cheese.
Right. It's a successful, productive Tuesday for me, but it is not making the encyclopedia.
Nor should it. But the error we make is assuming that because your Tuesday wasn't recorded, It wasn't essential to the ongoing functioning of your community and your own life.
The invisible maintenance is the substrate of reality.
It is. Now, this brings up a massive psychological hurdle that the framework anticipates we will hit. Because when we start talking about all these forgotten people, all the unrecorded lives doing the maintenance, there is a very natural, very powerful human temptation to romanticize them.
Oh, I felt that immediately when I first read this. My immediate instinct was to push back and say, wait, aren't these forgotten people the real heroes?
Right.
Aren't the invisible peasants, the uncredited workers, the anonymous mothers, aren't they the secretly noble, pure-hearted salt of the earth, while the kings and generals were all corrupt? It's a very satisfying Robin Hood-style narrative to flip the script like that.
It is deeply satisfying, which is exactly why the source material firmly, almost aggressively, dismantles that exact reflex.
Yeah, it does not let you get away with that.
The author calls it a lazy, comforting fiction. And it is vital that we understand the logic here. The silent of history grants no one virtue. The blank space of the unrecorded past doesn't magically purify the people who inhabit it. The argument makes this stark, uncompromising point. The silence swallows the patient, loving elder and the petty, abusive tyrant on identical terms.
Wow.
It swallows the diligent community steward and the cruel local brute into the exact same blank void.
That is a harsh reality check. Being forgotten doesn't make you a saint.
Statistically speaking, there were likely millions of horribly mean, incredibly selfish people who were also entirely forgotten because their cruelty just wasn't on a large enough scale to make the papers.
Right, they were just locally terrible.
Exactly. The unrecorded layer of humanity is vast beyond our cognitive limits. And because it encompasses almost everyone who has ever lived, its moral weight is completely, totally neutral.
It's just a demographic container.
Yeah. Yes. The vastness of the silence and the moral neutrality of that silence are two separate facts that must be kept apart. The discussion we are having here is not a moral judgment about who is good in the shadows.
So if it's not about who is good, what is it about?
It is purely about what lasts. It is about the structural mechanics of progress over deep time.
Okay, let's get into the mechanics then.
The material breaks down the mechanics of what lasts by analyzing a fundamental asymmetry in how humans operate. It looks at the difference between what we might call bad leadership and good leadership.
But not in terms of ethics, right?
Correct. In terms of architecture, how do these different styles interact with time? Let's examine the architectural structure of bad leadership first, which the framework defines as subtraction.
Subtraction. Let's paint the picture of the strongman, because that's the archetype the text uses. When I think of a strongman, I think of someone who takes, someone who breaks things, someone who hoards power.
Right.
But structurally, you're saying the most damaging thing the strongman does isn't the hoarding itself. It's that they narrow the entire system down to a choke point, and that choke point is themselves.
Exactly. Consider a corporate environment or a political regime built by this type of figure. They deliberately build a system where nothing can function, no decision can be made, and no resources can flow without their direct personal involvement or approval.
They engineer artificial indispensability.
That's the perfect term for it. They want everyone to believe the company or the country will fall apart if they aren't at the helm.
Yeah.
But the tragic structural flaw in that design is what inevitably happens when they leave.
Because everyone leaves eventually.
Right. When the strongman dies or is overthrown or even just retires, the entire situation violently resets. The system collapses because the whole arrangement was a house of cards leaning on one specific person who's no longer there.
So despite all the noise they made, all the headlines they generated, nothing actually accumulates. The net progress is zero.
Worse than zero, often. It leaves a vacuum that usually results in regression. That is the deliberate, ego-driven design of the strongman's tower. It is a massive flash in the pan that leaves no durable foundation behind.
Okay, so that's subtraction. Now contrast that with the framework's definition of compounding leadership. Compounding leadership doesn't subtract. It stacks.
It stacks.
So the compounding leader is the person who looks at a chaotic process, clears an obstruction out of the way, and simply hands the work onward to the next person.
Yes.
They don't demand a parade. They don't carve their name into the cleared path. They just leave a residue, as it's described, a residue that the next person can stand on and build upon.
And the fascinating part is it carries forward structurally whether or not anyone bothers to write down who cleared the path in the first place.
And this brings us to perhaps the most powerful mechanical metaphor in the entire text, the ratchet.
Oh, the ratchet metaphor is brilliant.
The author describes the actual lived reality of human progress not as a soaring eagle, but as a ratchet that only turns one way. I want to make sure everyone listening has the same mental image, so let's talk about how a ratchet actually works mechanically.
Please do.
A ratchet is a gear with angled teeth. It allows movement in one direction, but there's a little mechanical finger called a pawl that drops down into the teeth. If the gear tries to slip backward, the pawl catches the flat edge of the tooth and physically prevents the gear from reversing.
Right.
You turn it forward, you hear that click, and it holds its ground. It cannot go backward unless the whole mechanism is destroyed.
And the application of this mechanism to human history is just brilliant. Subtraction, the strong man, the tyrant, the destructive force, we just talked about that force, creates immense suffering and resets the immediate local situation.
Yeah.
But it rarely manages to fundamentally break the deep gear of overall human capacity. Contribution, however, engages the pawl, the quiet compounding work of millions of people clicking that gear forward one tiny tooth at a time.
The framework makes this incredibly resilient, hopeful argument. Over enough centuries, the stacking kind of behavior mathematically wins on net.
Not because the people who contribute are necessarily the majority of the population. Again, remember the moral neutrality we talked about.
Right. There's a lot of terrible people out there.
But simply because contribution is the only behavior that adds.
Mm-hmm.
By its very definition, it builds a foundation that outlives the actor.
I have to say, this realization completely stopped me in my tracks when I read it, because it grounds this lofty philosophy right into the reality you, the listener, are experiencing at this exact second.
How so?
Well, think about your life right now. The reason you can sit comfortably in a climate-controlled room or in your car, reading on a glowing piece of glass, casually asking a frontier artificial intelligence to translate a menu for you?
All miracles, essentially.
Right. The reason you have all this miraculous technology and comfort is emphatically not because the human past was a utopian paradise of kindness.
Far from it. As any historian will tell you, the past was brutally hard, largely unsanitary, and a very fair share of it was defined by absolute barbarism.
Exactly. The past was a nightmare for a lot of people. But you inherit this magnificent, highly complex, built-up world because stewardship, microscopic innovation, and quiet contribution are the only parts of human behavior that can survive forward.
They are the only parts that have the structural integrity to stack.
Yes, the destruction resets the board, but the tiny improvements, someone refining the wheel, someone improving the printing press, someone isolating the mold for penicillin, someone figuring out how to mass produce a microchip, those are the clicks of the ratchet moving forward.
It is a profound paradigm shift.
Yeah.
It forces us to acknowledge that the long-term survival and elevation of human civilization is not actually dependent on the loud, disruptive world historical figures who take up all the ink in the textbooks.
No.
It is entirely dependent on a radically different kind of figure. And this is where the author coins a term that challenges every modern notion of success.
Yes, the author creates a word for the specific type of person who intentionally grabs that ratchet and turns it forward. They call this person the obsoleter.
The obsoleter. It's a portmanteau, crashing together the words obsolete and leader.
And the text immediately confronts the elephant in the room here. It arrives sounding like a vicious insult.
It really does.
It sounds like the worst possible thing you could be. In our modern hustle culture, if you log on to social media or professional networks, obsolete is the ultimate failure state.
Right. It implies you're a dinosaur.
A relic. Someone who failed to adapt to the market and got left behind. An obsolete leader sounds like a manager who still wants people to use fax machines.
But the deliberate misreading of the word is the entire point. The obsoleter feels abrasive to our modern sensibilities because this figure is the exact polar opposite of the leader. We have all been heavily conditioned by the market to admire.
Right.
We are trained from business school to political campaigns to admire the strong man, the indispensable genius who solves everything themselves. But let's look at the actual anatomy of the obsoleter.
Let's do it.
If the strongman's entire value proposition depends on keeping the team or the society too weak to govern itself without him,
yeah,
the obsoleter's value proposition is the exact reverse.
I am going to play devil's advocate here, though.
Go for it.
If I'm a manager at a tech company and I deliberately make myself obsolete, if I train my team so well that they don't need me to approve anything and the processes run perfectly without my input, my boss is going to look at me and say, why are we paying you?
Yeah, that's the real world fear.
I'd get fired. How is this a sustainable model for a person?
That is the friction of the concept in a hypercapitalist structure that values visibility over capacity. The strongman stays employed by quietly degrading everyone else's capacity so he can swoop in and play the hero during a crisis of his own making.
Oh, we've all worked for that guy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The obsoleter, however, operates on a different timescale and a different metric of success. The obsoleter comes in and says, my entire function as a steward of this project is to make my own authority completely unnecessary.
They widen the channel.
They clear the blockage. They aggressively distribute knowledge. And here's the kicker, to your point about getting fired. The true obsoleter gladly accepts the obscurity and sometimes the loss of the position as the expected, necessary cost of ensuring the work continues independently of them.
They accept obscurity as the price of progress. Man, the text provides these incredibly vivid foundational examples of obsoleters throughout history to prove this isn't just theory.
I love these examples.
Think about the machinists during the Industrial Revolution. Men and women on factory floors who figured out how to thread a screw slightly better or make one tiny gear in a steam engine 3% more efficient.
Right.
They didn't stop the assembly line to demand a patent. They didn't become robber barons. They just made the machine better and let the next pair of hands build upon that refinement.
Or consider the example of the translators, which I think is one of the most poignant illustrations of this ethos.
Oh, this one is so good.
Think about the translation movements in places like the House of Wisdom in Baghdad or the monasteries in Ireland. You have people sitting in dusty, poorly lit rooms, painstakingly copying ancient Greek philosophical thought, translating it into Arabic, and then centuries later, others translating it into Latin.
Just grinding it out.
They were carrying this fragile flame of human knowledge across centuries of disease, war, and imperial collapse.
And for what?
Exactly. Why? Just so that someone else, hundreds of years in the future, could read it, spark the Renaissance, and become famous on the far side of history. The translators knew their names wouldn't be on the cover of the books. They were just carrying the water.
And then there's the military example, which strips the glamour right out of war. We all know the names of the famous generals. We study Napoleon, Alexander the Great, Patton.
The guys on the horses?
Right. But the framework asks us to redirect our attention to the quartermaster. The person sitting 3 miles behind the front lines, staring at a ledger by lamplight, desperately trying to figure out the mind-bending logistical nightmare of how 40,000 people and 10,000 horses are going to consume their caloric needs tomorrow in the middle of a muddy, hostile field.
Because if the quartermaster fails, the general doesn't even get to fight the battle.
The army just starves.
Yet none of those people, the machinist making the screw, the translator in the monastery, the quartermaster staring at the supply ledger, none of them are in your high school textbook.
But their quiet, compounding competence is the literal reason the textbook even exists to be written.
Exactly. The obsoleter is, by structural definition, not the name on the page. And the hardest part for our ego to swallow, the part that pushes back against everything we are taught, is that the true obsoleter is perfectly fine with that arrangement.
It makes me think about governance and how we organize society. If we want systems that actually last, shouldn't we be looking for systems that operate like obsoleter?
That is exactly where the material takes us next. It grounds this philosophical concept in hard economic and political theory, specifically bringing in the work of Eleanor Ostrom.
Great.
For context, Ostrom was a Nobel Prize-winning political economist who revolutionized how we think about the commons' shared resources, like local fisheries, communal forests, or grazing lands.
Because the dominant theory for decades was the tragedy of the commons.
Yes.
The assumption was that human beings are fundamentally selfish, and if you leave a group of people alone with a shared forest, they will chop down every last tree for their own quick profit. The accepted wisdom was that you absolutely need a strong man, either a strict central government or a ruthless private owner, to step in, police them, and stop them from destroying themselves.
And Ostrom empirically proved that assumption wrong.
How does she do that?
She traveled the world and studied communities that had successfully managed shared resources for centuries, sometimes millennia, without any central authority or strong man telling them what to do. She found that local communities are entirely capable of creating complex, self-governing rules that punish cheaters and preserve the resource. The text draws a direct, powerful parallel here. The arrangements that endure across deep time, the systems that actually survive the ratchet of history, are the ones where the stewardship is internalized by the community itself, rather than imposed from above by a center of power.
That is the obsoleter applied to a massive scale. Think about something modern, like Wikipedia.
Perfect example.
There is no central CEO of Wikipedia dictating what gets written. It is a massive self-governing commons maintained by millions of anonymous obsoleters who just want to get the facts right.
Exactly. Good governance, just like good leadership, refuses to leave a permanent, indispensable figure standing in the middle of the room. The system runs itself.
It's a beautiful concept, but it also leads us to a really emotional pivot in our source material. Because if the obsoleter is fundamentally invisible to history, what else is invisible? What else gets lost in that vast, empty room of the historical record?
The framework shifts the lens here. It moves from the grand, sweeping mechanics of civilization down to the deeply intimate, fragile scale of a single human life. And it poses a question that is almost poetic in its simplicity, but incredibly difficult to grapple with analytically.
And what's the question?
How much joy does a single human life hold?
It's a question that completely disarms you. How much joy does a single life hold? And the truth delivered here is heavy. Nobody knows.
There's no number for it.
There's no metric, no global database, no ledger that counts the laughter in a kitchen on a Tuesday night. There's no historical record of the time you were driving alone in your car and laughed out loud at a memory that nobody else on Earth would even understand.
And the reason there is no record of that joy isn't because historians are mean-spirited. The reason is structural to the medium of recording. Joy, by its very nature, generates no event.
That's profound.
Happiness files no headline. A happy, functional Tuesday where everyone in your house is healthy, the chores get done, the dog gets walked, and people are quietly kind to each other. That state of being records absolutely nothing. It leaves no footprint in the historical sediment because it requires no intervention.
Which means, conversely, if we look at what does get recorded in the news, the historical record, it's built entirely out of the tears. It's built out of the disaster, the collapse, the sudden war, the pandemic, because a catastrophe is an anomaly. It loudly records itself. It demands immediate attention and intervention.
The author draws a brilliant, inescapable parallel here between the history book and the evening news. We often treat them as different things, but structurally, they share the exact same algorithmic trick.
What's the trick?
Both of them run heavily doom-weighted. The history book keeps the 4 years of brutal war and completely skips the 4 decades of quiet peace that preceded it.
Mm-hmm.
The evening news broadcasts the local tragedy and skips the thousands of surrounding neighborhoods where absolutely nothing bad happened today. And the profound thesis statement the material makes is the news and history run doom-weighted, not because the human experience is mostly doom, but because doom is mostly what survives the filter of recording.
I love how the text phrases this, and I want to make sure I get it right. It says, the missing number for the laughter isn't a gap in the data, it is the argument.
It is the argument.
The fact that we can't count the joy isn't a glitch in our database that we need to fix with better tracking software. It is a fundamental truth about how human attention is structured. We only notice the house when it's on fire.
Exactly. The medium of history is fundamentally allergic to ordinary happiness.
So how does this apply to the listener? The text asks you to run this machinery somewhere you can actually feel it on your own skin. I want you to imagine measuring your own life solely by the metrics that make the evening news.
That's a scary thought experiment.
Think about your life as a news ticker. If an outside observer only had access to the breaking news moments of your existence, the car accidents, the painful breakups, the severe illnesses, the firings, the sudden deaths of loved ones, if that doom-weighted ledger was the only data they had, they would look at your life and conclude it was a relentless, unbroken catastrophe.
They would assume you lived in a state of constant agony. It would look like a nightmare from the outside.
But you know, sitting here right now, that is not the reality of your life. The real ledger of most lives, your life, my life, is the massive, uncounted part in the middle.
The Tuesday.
Yes, the Tuesday. It's that baseline competence at your job. It's the quiet warmth you show your friends when they call you to vent. It's that long stretch of peace, maybe years at a time, between two dated wars in your personal life. It's the time when life was simply lived, and it yielded absolutely no grand milestone to pin on a calendar.
This realization is so crucial because it frees us from the tyranny of the recorded metric. We are constantly pressured to prove our worth through measurable achievement. But we have to stop judging the success of our eras and the success of our own individual lives by the metrics of disaster and grand disruption that naturally force themselves into the record. We have to learn to fiercely value the uncounted ledger.
And the author has this fascinating, almost theatrical way of wrestling with this concept to explore the tension between the lived life and the historical record. They talk about writing these short mental plays.
Thought experiments.
Exactly. Thought experiments where they imagine historical figures standing right at the precipice of their legacy, right at the moment when they are about to become the static image that history remembers them as. And in these plays, the figure is visited by someone from the future.
It is a brilliant narrative device for exposing the gap between the human and the artifact. The visitor from the future holds the entire arc of the person's historical legacy in their hands and has to decide how to explain what survives and what gets thrown away.
The material gives us a few vivid, rapid-fire examples to set the stage before settling on the main one. First, imagine Vincent van Gogh. The play is set in Arles, France. It is minutes after he has cut off his own ear. He is in agony, bleeding, likely terrified of the rapid deterioration of his own mind. He is experiencing the absolute nadir of human suffering.
A truly horrific moment.
And the visitor from the future appears in the room. And Van Gogh doesn't ask if he gets famous. He doesn't ask how much his paintings will sell for at auction. His only question in that moment of absolute despair is whether the frantic transferring of colors to canvas is just falling into a hole. Will it matter?
And the future visitor has to deliver a sentence that is simultaneously the ultimate triumph and the ultimate tragedy. Yes, it matters, but not for you.
The work wins, the worker loses.
The canvas survives, the bleeding man in the room is erased. And then there's the example of Hedy Lamarr.
Oh, this one is so striking.
The brilliant Austrian-born actress. It's in 1942, the height of World War II. She has escaped a fascist marriage. She is in Hollywood, and she is sitting at a drafting table.
Not a movie set, a drafting table.
Right. She is sketching out a concept based on player piano mechanisms to create frequency hopping spread spectrum technology for Allied torpedoes.
Which sounds incredibly complex.
It is. It is the foundational technological architecture that now lives invisibly in every single smartphone, Wi-Fi connection, and Bluetooth device on Earth.
But the tragedy of the play is that she is sitting there, already half aware of the painful truth. Her famous, heavily commodified, beautiful face was the very thing that stopped the world from looking at her mind.
Exactly.
She knows the world will remember the glamour, the scandals, the silver screen, but will completely ignore the genius on the drafting table.
Both of those examples perfectly illustrate the tension. But then the author brings us back to where we started. Back to the room in Paris. Back to the damp cold, the scratching quill, and the candle burning down toward the dawn.
Yes, we return to Évariste Galois, the 20-year-old mathematician from our intro. The author writes this scene so beautifully. In the play, Galois doesn't even look up from the parchment when the visitor from the future arrives.
He's just too focused.
He keeps writing, the math pouring out of him, and he just asks the visitor, how many years? Meaning, how many years will this mathematics I am bleeding onto the page survive? And the visitor hesitates. They don't answer quickly enough.
Which tells Galois everything he needs to know about his legacy. The hesitation tells him the math survives indefinitely. It is immortal.
That many, Galois says. He finally sets the pen down. He realizes the ultimate cruelty of his situation. The math works. The math waits. The math wins. But as he says, staring at his own hands, I'm not invited to the part where it wins.
This is where the emotional core of the thought experiment just hits you with the force of a freight train.
Yeah.
Galois looks at the visitor and says, do you know what I'd give? Not for the winning. They can have the winning. For the time. 10 more years at this table and I'd build the whole of it, not these scraps down the side of the page.
Man.
He would trade all of his immortal historical fame, all of his legacy as a mathematical prodigy, for just 10 ordinary years of quiet work. 10 more unrecorded Tuesdays.
And the visitor points to the frantic margin notes. I have no time. The visitor says, it's not nothing, the note. You're wrong about that. The note is the part that lives.
And Galois gives this sad, almost smile, and realizes the truth. It's a cruel, asymmetric arithmetic. The note lives, the boy dies, and the world keeps the cheaper half.
The cheaper half. It is such a devastating way to frame it. The artifact, the mathematical formula, the Van Gogh painting of sunflowers, the patent for frequency hopping, that's the cheap part.
Exactly.
The human being who poured their soul into it, the complex, breathing human who actually experienced the joy, the terror, and the frustration of making it, that's the expensive part. And that's the part the universe demands we lose forever.
The author provides a vital operational rule for writing these theatrical thought experiments, and I think it's crucial to highlight it to understand the tone of the framework.
What's the rule?
The visitor from the future is never allowed to arrive acting superior. The future isn't allowed to be arrogant just because it knows how the story ends. The rule that keeps the play emotionally honest is that the future arrives humbled. They come deeply aware of the living person in front of them, carrying the knowledge of the future the way you carry a heavy, fragile object you can't put down.
That changes the whole dynamic.
Everything the visitor knows lands as a profound loss. They are constantly looking at the human and thinking, look at how much of you got thrown away. It is never played as a trick on the past.
This raises an important question about how we view the things that do survive, which the source material addresses in a really clinical, fascinating way. It defines this concept of the cheaper half as survivorship bias pointed at virtue.
Survivorship bias pointed at virtue.
It's a dense phrase, so let's unpack the mechanics of it.
Yeah, let's break it down.
Normal survivorship bias is the classic World War II bomber problem. The military looks at the bombers that return from combat covered in bullet holes, and they decide to reinforce the armor on the areas where the planes got shot.
Right. They completely forget that the bombers that didn't return were shot in the engine or the cockpit. They focus entirely on the survivors and draw false, sometimes fatal, conclusions about the whole data set.
Right. If you only look at the survivals, you get a completely distorted view of the war. But here, the framework argues the bias is pointed at virtue.
At the good things.
Yes. At the enduring artifacts, the masterpieces, the technological breakthroughs, the durable artifact, the painting, the math survives the brutal meat grinder of history. It makes it back to the base. We put it in a museum and we celebrate the artifact. But humanity completely loses the person who made it.
And the tragedy, the bias, is that we celebrate a transaction that the creator themselves would have violently rejected. We cheer for the artifact, ignoring the fact that Van Gogh or Galois would have traded all that historic fame back in a heartbeat for just 10 ordinary healthy years of life.
It is a profound structural loss. And acknowledging that loss brings us to the final major concept of the deep dive. We've spent the last hour identifying this massive gaping chasm, the gap between the lived reality of humanity, which is full of uncounted joy, quiet maintenance, and the compounding work of obsoleters, and the sparse, doom-weighted highlight reel that we accept as history.
So the inevitable question is, how do we close the gap?
How do we fix it? And the author begins to answer this by turning the lens on themselves, demonstrating a remarkable amount of humility. They note that as a writer in the modern age, they have their own digital footprint.
Right. The search engine results.
Yeah. A credit here, a byline there, an author page on a website, what they call a marginal digital. I was here. But they are the first to admit that these little digital blips badly, comically, undersell the 20 years of actual messy lived experience behind them.
The author says, I'm a data point who knows the data point is lossy. It's a perfect technical metaphor.
Lossy data, like a JPEG image file. I was thinking about this when I read it.
Oh, that's a great comparison.
If you take a massive, high-resolution, raw photograph of a forest, it has millions of colors, but the file is too big to send over email, so you compress it into a JPEG.
Right.
The computer algorithm looks at the photo and says, we don't need 3,000 shades of green. Let's just make them all one shade of dark green. It throws away the data to save space. It becomes lossy.
And that is exactly what we do to human beings to fit them into the historical record.
We compress them until all the nuance, the sweat, and the laughter is thrown away. Anyone who has ever tried to condense the totality of their professional life into a one-page resume or their entire personality into a dating app profile knows exactly the anxiety of being a lossy data point.
And the framework explains exactly why the data point must be lossy. The root cause is scale.
Scale.
The author argues that when we say the world is too big, we aren't just using a poetic metaphor to express feeling overwhelmed. It is a literal biological measurable mismatch.
Between what and what?
There is a profound mismatch between the massive size of the global civilizations and social networks we have built and the actual biological size of the attention the human brains are issued.
Oh, we have a hard cognitive ceiling.
Exactly.
Anthropologists call it Dunbar's number. The idea that our brains are really only wired to maintain stable social relationships with about 150 people.
Right.
We literally do not have the neural architecture to truly care about and hold in our deep regard the nuanced lives of 8 billion people. So because the world is too big for our primate brains, we build a historical record that acts as a massive JPEG compression algorithm.
It keeps a tiny, low-resolution sliver of information and loses all the substance.
And our great mistake as a species was looking at the filtered, compressed sliver and thinking it was the whole high-resolution reality.
This biological scale problem connects directly to a profound observation the material makes about modern technology. It analyzes the modern social media feed through this exact same lens.
Let's talk about that.
What is a social media feed, functionally? It is an algorithm that perfectly optimizes for the recorded highlight reel layer of life. It demands the milestone, the engagement metric, the outrage, the climax.
It demands the modern equivalent of the slam dunk.
Exactly.
But hold on, if social media is just doing what history does, are we saying social media is inherently evil? Should we all just delete our accounts?
Not necessarily evil, but structurally deficient for human happiness.
Mm-hmm.
The text isn't a Luddite manifesto. It is pointing out that the feed is demanding a performance of highlights. What is the actual substrate underneath that feed? What is the real reality of your social network?
And what do they conclude it is?
The author argues the true substrate is the unspoken warmth you feel for people. It's the fact that you feel genuine warmth, affection, and respect for your friends, your family, and your colleagues far more often than you ever actually articulate to them.
And this is where the author's work reveals its ultimate practical purpose. They state that this entire philosophy of the uncounted ledger sits upstream of both social media and therapy.
Upstream is the key word here.
Meaning what?
Meaning, if we fix this problem at the source, we might not need the downstream interventions as desperately. If social media is desperately trying to aggregate our highlights to prove we exist, and therapy is trying to help us cope with the deep isolation and the feeling of being invisible despite our metrics, the framework is suggesting a different path.
It's saying, let's go upstream. Let's close the gap between the warmth we internally feel and the warmth we actually express before it becomes just another uncounted Tuesday.
Which leads us to the ultimate call to action. The material makes it very clear what the solution is not. The solution is not to just start recording more things.
Right. We don't need a blockchain for every time someone makes a good cup of coffee. We don't need to strap cameras to our heads to document every moment of joy.
Yeah.
That just adds to the deafening, compressed noise of the world.
So how do we actually fix it?
Yeah.
We fix it at the scale where human regard is still biologically and cognitively real.
Yes.
We fix it one small 150-person circle at a time. We do it by actively looking at the people in our immediate physical lives, the people whose warmth, whose diligent maintenance work, whose quiet compounding competence will never, ever reach the pages of an encyclopedia.
Mm.
And we do the radical act of telling them that we noticed.
We tell them while they are still here. As the text so beautifully commands, while it is still pencil on a candle, before the world decides it only wants the still convenient version.
We acknowledge the living, breathing, complex human being standing in front of us before they just become a static memory or a lossy data point.
Nobody is going to count the laughter for you. That's the job.
That's the job.
It's such an empowering command to end on. It takes all the immense, crushing pressure off of trying to be a world historical figure. You don't need to be Napoleon. You don't need to be Steve Jobs. It puts all the importance, all the moral weight on being a good steward of your own small circle.
It is a total radical reframing of what it means to leave a legacy.
So, to bring it all together for you, the listener, we have covered an immense amount of ground today. We started in a cold room in Paris with a doomed 20-year-old mathematician scribbling his genius into the margins while the clock ran out.
Right.
We completely dismantled the illusion of the history book, revealing it as a highly compressed highlight reel that skips the actual mundane film of human progress. We learned that the silence of history is vast and morally neutral, swallowing the good and the bad alike without judgment.
We explored the structural mechanics of progress, how the strong man subtracts, hoards, and resets the board, while the quiet, invisible stewardship of compounding leadership turns the ratchet of civilization forward, one click at a time.
We met the obsoleter, the beautiful, countercultural figure who works tirelessly to make themselves unnecessary, accepting obscurity as the necessary price of building a self-sustaining world.
We realized that true joy and laughter leave no historical footprint, meaning the record will always run doom-weighted, just like the evening news.
And we confronted the tragedy of the cheaper half, the structural reality that the world takes the durable artifact and loses the precious, unrepeatable human who suffered to make it.
All leading to that final vital mission.
Mm-hmm.
You have to count the laughter in your own life.
Mm-hmm.
You have to notice the unrecorded work of the people around you, because the history books absolutely will not do it for you.
And as we close out this deep dive, I want to offer you one final, slightly provocative thought to mull over. Something that builds entirely on the framework of this text, but pushes its logic to the absolute limit.
No, I like where this is going.
Let's call it the blank history paradox.
I am intrigued. Walk me through the blank history book paradox.
Okay, think about the logical conclusion of everything we've discussed.
Right.
If history is fundamentally just a highlight reel of massive disruptions, terrible wars, collapsing empires, and loud strongmen who bottleneck progress. And if, on the other hand, the ultimate goal of human advancement is to become a society filled entirely with obsoleters, people who quietly compound progress, who clear blockages, who steward resources perfectly, like Ostrom's Commons, who resolve problems long before they ever become catastrophes.
Wait. If we actually achieve that, if we built a society of pure obsoleters.
Exactly. If we all do our jobs perfectly, if human civilization reaches its absolute highest, most thriving, most peaceful peak, where everyone is focused entirely on counting the laughter in their small circles and quietly turning the ratchet of progress forward.
Wouldn't the ultimate measure of a perfectly successful civilization be a completely, utterly blank history book?
Because nothing terrible would ever happen that would force itself into the record. There would be no splice mark.
Precisely. If there are no wars, no despots, no sudden catastrophes, the chroniclers have absolutely nothing to write about. The highest possible achievement of humanity might just be creating an era where literally nothing is written down. Because every single day is an unbroken, unrecorded, perfectly ordinary, perfectly happy Tuesday.
That is an incredible thought to end on. A blank page, not as a sign of failure, but as the ultimate sign of victory. It really makes you rethink what you are aiming for when you wake up every day.
It changes everything.
Because at the end of it all, when the candle is burning low and the wax is pooling on the table, it's not the encyclopedia entry that matters. It's the warmth in the room, the work you handed forward, and the people who noticed you were there.
The note lives. But we don't have to lose the person. Not if we do the job.
Not if we do the job. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Go count the laughter today.